How do you build a high-performance team? That's the question that all leaders grapple with. The challenge in today's environment is that you're told to pull this off on a shoestring budget and that you have to exceed previous year's production. It's an impossible task. Here's how this show helps. Every week, we're going to feature executive and senior leaders from HR, IT, and sales, and they're going to share their best practices and playbooks so you can empower your managers to build great teams. We are Engaging Leadership, and now, here's the show.
Hello, everyone. My name is Chitong, or CT, and I'm the co-founder of Engage Rocket. At Engage Rocket, we help school districts to use analytics to improve teacher retention and engagement, as well as student achievement outcomes. And today I have the great pleasure to be interviewing Dr. Jamie Nutter. He's the executive director of CESA 3, former superintendent of Fenimore Community School District, and a recognized superintendent of the year in Wisconsin. Welcome to the show, Dr. Nutter.
Oh, thanks for having me. I really appreciate being here.
Perhaps to get us started, could you share a little bit more about what you do at CESA, or what CESA does, and your experiences leading in the educational space?
Yeah, certainly. For those familiar with the education space, they might be familiar with the terms AEA, Area Education Agencies. In Wisconsin, we refer to them as Cooperative Education Service Agencies. And there's 12 of us in Wisconsin, and I serve in Southwest Wisconsin. In our region, we serve 31 school districts covering about 4,000 square miles, close to 20,000 students, so we're fairly rural. We provide a variety of services from professional development to special education, to leadership services, to our school districts. I get the privilege of working directly with the superintendents of each of those school districts in our monthly superintendent meetings.
You're coming to this position with an extensive amount of experience as an educator and a leader yourself. Maybe if you could share a little bit more about that background.
Yeah. So prior to my role as the director here at CESA 3, I was a superintendent for 9 years in a rural school district in Wisconsin, where our mission was to provide suburban opportunities in a rural district. That was our whole vision, and everything that we did along with core values and drove our mission was to provide more opportunities for students. Prior to that, I was a principal in a school district where I was very blessed to have a lot of experience. In fact, we were the fourth experienced district in the state. I learned a lot about leadership. Being an inexperienced and young principal, I had the privilege of working with a great team of teachers and other administrators who helped me gain that foundation. And prior to that, I was a coach, teacher, and community member in school districts.
I'm really curious, when you talked about providing a suburban educational experience in a rural school district, tell me a little bit more about what that difference is and how you've approached it as a superintendent at that time.
So when we look at from a rural standpoint, when we look at our suburban counterparts, there's a lot more access to resources. Typically, there's the opportunity to raise more dollars if needed for programs. And those school districts, their students tend to have access to advanced placement opportunities, dual credit opportunities, a variety of academic and career plans. And so in rural districts, in order to do that, we had to really view ourselves as partners in our community and had to help our community members think about that as a vision as well and be committed to that. As a result, I was very blessed to be in a community where it was a shared vision. That was a part of it. In order to commit to that, so many times we hear about the school and the community. For example, people will say, we need to be a greater part of the community, as if we're not already a part of the community. In fact, school districts in rural areas are the center of their communities. We started changing that conversation to be other aspects of the community versus the community as something different. So that whole commitment provided a lot of opportunities for students. Being in a rural school district, we had several students going to universities that would have the equivalent of a year and a half of credits earned before they even walked in the front doors of universities. We had people earning close to associate's degrees while they were still in high school. They had access to youth apprenticeships. We had to really partner in order to take full advantage of those opportunities for our students. Whereas more in the suburban school districts, they're readily available. There's just a plethora of opportunities.
Okay, that makes sense. And I think you touched on something that I found so unique about leadership in education, particularly in rural and urban sub-school districts, where essentially in a leadership position within the school district, you are also de facto in some form of leadership within the community. You have to be able to move people, not just within the school, so not just your staff, the teachers, and the students, but you have to move the rest of the community that you're plugged into. And by the nature of your position, you have to influence them. What were some of the levers that you used to engage the rest of these stakeholders, especially in a more rural environment where they're quite spread out and it's difficult to get that kind of face-to-face contact with everyone at a single time?
Yeah, I would say probably what reflected the most of that in my superintendent experience is the fact that my community named me as one of the citizens of the year in a particular year, because I think you have to be visible. You have to be engaged in the community as a whole. We think about enrollment, for example, as one of the indicators of success in order to have resources. In order for school districts to have enrollment, you have to be partners with industry and economic development. School enrollment and the quality of the school district drives economic development, but economic development and growth also drives enrollment. So the two are interdependent. So many times people stay in their own silos or their own lanes and they don't interact. And so there's a vested interest in communities where schools are successful in both of them. So being a part of the chamber, being a part of civic organizations, getting to know people, sharing your story, telling people that vision that we have for our students, because it's really hard for other aspects of the community to argue with the fact that we want to provide more opportunities or higher quality for our students. So as a result of that, in the community where I served, out of all of the school districts in Wisconsin, a small rural school district in Fenimore was ranked as high as 5th in the state, according to U.S. News and World Report, when it came to college readiness. That all resulted in the community aspect. For example, in Wisconsin, we have revenue caps. So we can't raise money unless our voters approve that opportunity. In the community where I served, in one of our referenda, 84% of the community approved that with high numbers of voter turnout. We had another one where we needed more dollars to achieve our vision, and 78% more approved that. So it does require a lot of community partnerships on when you're looking outside of the school into the community as a whole.
What made you want to get into leadership within education?
I guess I give that credit to my principal and superintendent when I was a teacher. They saw some leadership in me that I didn't see. So very early on, the administrators in my school recruited me to be a part of an aspiring administrator program offered by our state organization and tapped me as a representative for regional leadership. When I had the opportunity to get around like-minded people, it was just really exciting to hear of all the possibilities, to be around other people that looked for all the reasons we should do things or we should provide opportunities versus all the reasons that we should not. Being able to understand that influence is what drove me. And then to try to motivate others to think about what are the possibilities that we can provide for people. Let's just not settle for the fact that we live in rural areas. What's stopping us? So to be around other people who had a growth mindset really motivated me to continue my leadership path.
That's great. Today, you're in a position where you're influencing leaders in many school districts at all levels, and particularly at all the way to the very top. Do you find that this is something that you're experiencing, having to almost engage them and help them see their roles in their communities in a different way so that they can unlock the amount of influence that they could have on different spheres of influence?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, at CESA 3, when a district hires a new superintendent, as members, they automatically get access to a superintendent academy that I refer to as what they didn't teach you in superintendent school. It revolves around those professional relationships, some technical aspects, but just really understanding what drives positive change. I'm in a very unique position, and I'm very privileged to be able to have colleagues in Southwest Wisconsin and be able to learn from new superintendents who still have that mindset of what if, how do we change to keep me growing, as well as talking about, have you considered X, Y, and Z? So that, I would say, is probably the biggest privilege I have right now as a leader in a region. That's very satisfying for me to be able to work with high quality individuals.
Yeah, I think you touched on a really good point, because I don't think so far in my observation that any role in education prepares you for the role of the superintendent. Not really, right? Once you take on that job, and it's pretty much the same in many organizations where you can be on the ground and you can be leaders in different parts of the organization, but once you're the superintendent, suddenly all eyes are on you, and you pretty much, however much preparation you've had, it's a new experience the first time you're doing it. At CESA, do you have any kind of programs or any recommendations for people that are either considering the superintendent role or are just about to step into it for the first time? Do you have any perspective on how to prepare them for that role?
I recall that it was in my seventh year as an elementary principal in a leadership position, where I had this aha moment. I discovered that I'm responsible to be a leader. I'm responsible to promote best practices. I'm responsible to provide feedback, support, accountability, and contribute to culture. But it's not my fault if there are people who are not satisfied. Now, I'm not going to settle for the fact that there might not be people who I'm serving that might not be satisfied. But I learned that there's a lot of factors that I can't control. So I had this epiphany of, I can't be responsible for other people's happiness, but I'm going to try. But prior to that, when things didn't go right, or if people weren't satisfied, or if there was maybe a disagreement between staff members, my pillow would get hot on one side at night because it would just eat me up, and I would flip the pillow over and I wouldn't be taking care of myself from a health standpoint because I would be stressing and worrying about this. Once I realized that, I could focus more objectively on how do we continue to create strategies for students versus me fixing relationships all the time. And so when I think about leaders who are stepping into the superintendent, they hear this all the time. Hey, you can't take things personally. You have to have thick skin. The words and the feeling are two different components. Once you understand that feeling that you get it, that aha moment, then you're ready for that next level. If you're stepping into that level while you're still reflecting on that and you understand it rationally, but you don't feel it, you still have to continue to work toward that, and you have to do a lot of self-talk. And it doesn't really matter where you lead. It still comes down to really working with other people, staying true to who you are as a leader, focusing on the outcomes and the mission.
That I really like how you put it. That idea that you have to have that feeling and epiphany, and it has to be so personal and emotional to every individual, where it's a switch flips. You go from taking on the weight of the world and the burdens to realizing with some humility that there's only that much you can control. Once you get that flip, it then becomes easier to lead and pursue the vision that matters and pursue the big picture and bring more people on board. We talked a lot about professional learning communities. Could you talk a little bit about what you've seen tying some of the research around these professional learning communities with your efficacy in the different roles that you've seen?
Yeah, so when we think about professional learning communities of practice, there's a misconception that if we just engage in PLCs or professional learning communities from an education standpoint, we're automatically going to see positive results. That's because the intention is to mimic or copy successful organizations. And part of successful organizations oftentimes have some communities of practice or professional learning communities. Really look at the research around the beginnings of professional learning communities, it really is just one component of culture, right? So professional collaboration is the key part of professional learning communities. And creating an opportunity to collaborate in itself does not gain results. The research is pretty clear about that. No matter what study it is, whether it's John Hattie, Visible Learning, whether we go back to Marzano, whether we go all the way back into the 60s with Edgar Schein from MIT, looking at the relationships of organizational culture and the bottom line, it really comes down to that efficacy and that self-determination. For example, school districts that have late starts, early releases, or time for professional collaboration, if the purpose of that isn't to develop a belief of efficacy or self-determination and efficacy within their staff, then that practice in itself is not going to be effective. So the whole idea is to be intentional about creating strong efficacy. We define efficacy in education as the belief that we are the biggest difference makers in the lives of our students. So in other words, if we were not a variable in their lives, they wouldn't learn. Versus if students are learning because of their background, because of their opportunities, then we don't make that difference. And so to have efficacy means that we know that we're the biggest difference. When we look at collective teacher efficacy, we're looking at our teammates, we're looking at our departments, we're looking across all of the team members to say, you know what, we are the biggest difference makers in the lives of our students. So everything that we do in our culture has to be geared toward that intention. But just checking off a box to say, okay, we're going to do this component and we hope to get these results is not as effective. The research is pretty clear that those organizations that engage in professional learning communities to improve their culture or to improve their efficacy are the ones that get results.
Wow, it's been a great conversation so far. Make sure you join the HR Impact Community, where we gather a community of HR leaders just like you. This is a space where top people leaders share actionable insights and practical playbooks. Sign up today as a member for the community. Get updates on the latest HR resources and exclusive event invites. You can join the community at www.engagerocket.co/HR Impact. And now, back to the show.
That's a very nuanced point. Say if I'm a superintendent of a school district and I'm seeing all this good stuff about PLCs and I'm thinking, all right, I need to start implementing this within my district. From what I'm hearing, there's two ways to do it. There's all right, let's just implement it. And then the other way is to implement it with the mindset of this has to drive efficacy, which is driven by that belief that we are the primary driver of student achievement. How do you make that difference as a superintendent? How do you very intentionally apply this?
I think when we begin any processes, we have to think about those system drivers. And so there's some level of accountability no matter what we do, where we're tight, where we're loose, how we lead, the feedback that we provide, the support that we provide is really critical. If we're providing time for teams to establish norms and common assessments and discuss best practices to get those results on those common assessments, there has to be some expectations. And just standing in front of a group of people and verbally sharing an expectations from a leader does not necessarily mean that we're going to get those results. So being willing to be able to be that guide to provide accountability with feedback, understanding where the barriers are to provide that support. In the end, the reason we want to talk about best practices is because we want individuals to grow. We want them to continue to understand and adapt and change to those external problems that we're trying to solve with achievement. As a superintendent, to be intentional that we want our educators to grow so that students become those positive recipients of our practices.
I also liked how you mentioned that this whole idea of PLCs as a program or as a lever to driving efficacy has to be seen as part of a larger whole of the culture of the teams that you're building. Tell me a little bit more about how you get a handle on this culture and mold it as a leader.
I was very fortunate in my doctorate program, I engaged in research. And as a part of my literature review, I read or reviewed dozens of books, into the hundreds of leaders, educational leaders who studied school culture. And as we think about culture as a whole, we have to be intentional about it. And we have to understand what is its purpose. We can't understand culture unless we really go back to saturation points. And when we look at those saturation points, it goes back to Edgar Schein from MIT. Edgar Schein said that organizational culture exists for an organization to be able to solve their external problems. He also defined it as, and I'm going to paraphrase here, but the behaviors and the interactions of its members, of how they solve that external problem. So in education, our external problem is learning, achievement for our students. That's what defines us, is the problems that we're trying to solve, what we've been called to do. We have to really understand what components of that culture we're trying to change. One of the things we hear about often, and one of the trends in education, is that we're seeing more and more having communication directors so that schools are able to tell their stories. There's so many misconceptions out there and competing storytellers, whether it's social media, whether it's a small component of the large media. They maybe want to work on brand, or they want to improve their brand. They want to improve their storytelling. Edgar Schein would say, okay, that's just one component. That's the artifacts. That's what we tell people. And then Schein goes into the espoused values. It's what we tell everybody within our organization. So in other words, we tell the outside world what we're about with our brand and our mission and our vision statements. We also tell each other what we're about. And then finally, we really dig down into what's the individual belief of the members. So we tell the outside world we're about this. We tell each other we're about this. In order to really make that change as a member, I need to know that what we're saying aligns with our practices. And so that constant work of tweaking that culture and looking at those activities. In fact, Wagner developed a tool called the School Culture Triage Survey and really gets at Edgar Schein's work in a more measurable way. The School Culture Triage Survey measures three components of culture. Those include professional collaboration. That's how do we interact with each other. We've talked at length about PLCs. That's a big part of professional collaboration. And then affiliative collegiality. How well do we get along? How do we like the people that we're interacting with, which is a key component of trust? And we know all the research about trust and culture. And finally, Wagner's tool measures that self-efficacy or self-determination, because the only way we know what's going on in the minds of the individuals is to gather that information by asking them. So as leaders are looking at components of culture, they have to be intentional. For example, maybe they're engaging staff and providing an opportunity for a team building activity. Maybe it's a mystery bus tour that ends up at a bowling alley. That in itself is not going to solve that external problem that the culture is trying to solve. But it may be helping individuals build more trust, and that trust leads to collective efficacy, because I have to trust the people that I'm working with. If I'm changing the mascot or I'm posting the vision statement outside of my school, that is to increase the belief in what we do as an organization, to increase that collective efficacy. And so as we think about developing culture, it all has to be intentional, and it all has to move toward that self-determination and that belief and that efficacy. So the advice that I would give any leader based on the research is to be intentional about all the practices. It can't be just about feeling good. Certainly that's important. We want great morale. We want people to feel good, but it has to be about that intention. But to get the greatest amount of satisfaction, it has to be about accomplishment. It has to be about success. It just can't be because people tell us we're great. We have to internalize that and feel that ourselves. And that's what a leader has to try to bring out. And they can't give that to the members. The members have to feel that and earn that. And the leader is to help them earn that.
In culture, we now have these three different elements, at least within the culture triage survey. The measurement instrument then comes in to provide a certain level of accountability, a certain level of sense of progress that is measurable and tangible. And there's this internal compass that needs to align and change that the leader needs to drive people that are following him or her. And that whole orchestra, it sounds like a lot of skill to be able to deliver effectively. So one of the things that drives that is coaching, because you become a better leader by being coached by a better leader. You must have seen this a lot in your own experience coaching leaders in your organization and now like coaching leaders in many different organizations. What are some of the critical insights that you've come across when trying to elevate someone to become a leader that they could be?
Part of that is to be able to think about problems, to think about barriers without taking it personally. When we went back earlier in our conversation, I talked about that epiphany. Not taking things personally is a key part in that, because if somebody comes and talks to me about an issue or a barrier, there's two ways I can look at that. One is I could say, as a leader, I should have seen that. So they're pointing out a weakness to me because I'm not smart enough to see that's a problem. Or I could look at that objectively and understand that one of my team members is communicating the fact that there is a barrier to us achieving our vision or that perfection. If we can figure out a way to solve that problem, we could be better as an organization. And so that requires me to be at my best every single day. On our team here at CISA 3, we have trained coaches, and we really work hard at recognizing catabolic energy versus anabolic energy, because my instincts are often to respond to negativity or respond to barriers with negativity versus looking at it as an opportunity. So I would say that first key is to be able to look outside yourself as a leader and understand that no matter how hard you work, no leader is perfect, but we're going to strive for our organization to be perfect when people celebrate victories or they identify barriers. Then we're going to either build on that or we're going to try to remove the barriers to help our organization to succeed. It really comes down to having that confidence and not being insecure or working toward not being insecure about open communication. And finally, the final point that I'll make is if I'm insecure about our team pointing out barriers and I react in a negative aspect, they're not going to come to me anymore. They're not going to trust me because they're going to think that they hurt my feelings or I'm going to get mad. And then an opportunity to make our organization better is lost because as the leader, people can't trust me enough to be honest.
It sounds so critical to be able to take the ego out of the situation as a leader. As you said, like not to take things personally, because as a leader, you exist outside yourself, right? You're playing an important role in an organization, and it's got nothing to do with that ego that we have about personal feelings, about certain issues. We have to think for the organization, like what is best for everyone. How much do you feel that leaders in school districts today invest in building up their leadership bench? It sounds like it's something that's really hard to do, but it's also something that takes time out of the regular daily operations and could be seen as a long-term investment, which may not pay off over the next 3 months or 6 months or a school year. Do you feel like we're investing enough in building future leaders in our pipelines?
I would say that every leader has a different style to get those outcomes. But we go back to whether it's Stephen Covey, whether it's other leaders, right? We know that slow is fast and fast is slow. And if trust is a key component of efficacy, and we know the research is undeniable about collective teacher efficacy to get results, then we know that we have to build trust. And that's one person at a time, one relationship at a time. And that's one conversation. I can't do that at a staff meeting and start spewing off a bunch of expectations. I can't do that by simply adjusting the pay scale. I can't do that by simply making the lives and the working conditions better for the individual. Certainly all of those things are components from a continuity standpoint. But if we invest in individuals and we invest in those relationships, we have to be working toward trust because trust has a value. People will give up money if the working conditions and there's trust and they want to be a part of something bigger than themselves. But that takes a lot of time, and no amount of AI, no amount of computer applications are going to do that. Relationships are the key part of the experience when we're creating effective schools.
Yeah, that foundational layer of trust, pretty much everything depends on that. If you don't have that layer, then there's too much organizational energies that are wasted pulling in many different directions because there's no foundation of trust. You've shared a lot with us today, Dr. Nada. Thank you so much for your insight. If there was one key takeaway that you wanted to share with leaders in education for them to remember and to be able to lead more effectively, what would that be?
Any amount of success or that belief is really going to be about preparation. It's going to be about how much time planning to be intentional toward the outcome. The trust culture, it's all part of a natural process that requires a lot of investment, a lot of preparation. And the more leaders prepare, the more confident they are in their abilities, in the outcomes, and that will help to get to that aha moment that each need in order to not take everything personally in a day and age when they're expected to do so much.
Such a timely reminder. Slow is fast and fast is slow. Thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your thoughts, Dr. Nada. It's been such a pleasure.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Engaging Leadership. We hope you liked the conversation. Don't forget to continue supporting us by joining the HR Impact community. You can find our community at www.engagerocket.co/HR Impact. Tune in next time where we'll have another leader joining us and sharing with us the game-changing insights that help them build high-performing teams.